Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the AI revolution is going to change everything. Northeastern's President Joseph Aoun says higher education better change with it.
Society is changing. The world is changing. Higher education needs to change.
Also today, Sandy Hook families take their case against a major gun manufacturer to Connecticut's highest court.
They obviously weren't looking for murderers, but they were ringing bells.
And we'll get the latest on what's happening at Berklee College of Music after students marched against the administration there and its handling of sexual harassment on campus. Plus, remembering the Red Sox silent captain, Bobby Doerr.
I've found that when I make a good play and take my picture off the hook, it's just natural for me to feel better than if I made a flashy play that doesn't do anything except make me look good for the grandstand.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Now, Remington may never have known Adam Lanza, but they had been courting him for years.
That is how oral argument in Connecticut State Supreme Court began today. Families of those killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting are attempting to make the case that a major gun manufacturer, Remington Outdoor Company, should be held responsible for the Newtown mass shooting because the company's military-style marketing, they say, was designed to appeal to young men like the Sandy Hook shooter. Here's the family's lawyer, Joshua Koskoff.
The weapon he needed for his mission that day was never in doubt. It was, and I'm quoting, according to the defendants, the uncompromising choice when you demand a rifle as mission adaptable as you are.
Remington's lawyer, James Vokes, rejected the plaintiff's arguments and pointed to federal law that protects gun manufacturers from liability.
The manufacturer and the sellers of the firearm used by the criminal that day are not legally responsible for his crimes and the harm that he caused.
Well, WNPR reporter Patrick Scahill was at Connecticut State Supreme Court in Hartford today, and he joins us now. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, you're welcome.
Well, first of all, can you tell us what the scene was like in the courtroom as oral argument was going on today?
Well, this is a case that's been going through the courts here in Connecticut for a few years now, and the scene at the courthouse was pretty tame. It was a really, really rainy day. There were a few family members of victims who were at the courthouse, and one actually spoke afterwards to reporters. But lawyers essentially presented their arguments on both sides, as we just heard, to the state Supreme Court, again, in this case, which has been going on for a few years now here in Connecticut.
Right. So you said one of the family members spoke to reporters after oral argument today. What did they say?
So that was Ian Hockley. His son, Dylan, was one of the students who was murdered at Sandy Hook. And he was essentially saying that this AR-15-style weapon, which was used to perpetrate the crime, is a military weapon. This is given it's a weapon that's given to people who get extensive training in the military. It's not fit for civilian use. And that's the case that lawyers were also making in the courthouse today. Mm.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, because we should note that this is at the Connecticut State Supreme Court today because the families have lost in lower courts and they are appealing. And what they're trying
correct.
To do, if I have this correct, Patrick, is basically this is a case in order that they're trying to win so that they can sue Remington, because right now that's the issue that's at dispute, right?
Yeah, so this gets us to federal law, and I won't get too in the weeds on this, but essentially it goes to a law called the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. This is a law that passed Congress in 2005 and gives really broad immunity to firearms manufacturers and dealers. But under the law, there is what plaintiffs in this case are seeing as an opening, and this goes to a tort called negligent entrustment. This basically works where the entruster makes available something that could be considered potentially dangerous to another party, and then harm is committed with that item by that party. Then you can say, okay, well, the entruster can be held responsible. So typically in case law, this is a point of sale issue. Seller gives an instrument to a buyer, and buyer does something bad with that. Seller mm-hmm. should have known it, and they shouldn't have done it. But the unique part of this argument here is that lawyers for the plaintiffs are actually broadening the scope and saying it's not the point of sale that's at issue. It's how this weapon was marketed by Remington to specific demographics, which they say include the shooter at Newtown.
Which, according to their argument, then wouldn't, again, as they see it, wouldn't require the manufacturer to know specifically that the person they're selling to may go on to commit a crime. I mean, we've got a little bit more tape here to this exact point that you're talking about, Patrick. Again, this is the plaintiff's lawyer, the family's lawyer, Joshua Koskoff, kind of giving another example of a situation in which they say that their argument would hold true, that other companies could or should be held liable for their actions. Here's his example.
Can you imagine Ford Motor Company advertising one of their cars to go run over people, or showing somebody in a combat mission having a lone gunman or a lone driver having just completed their mission? Who would hesitate for a second to hold Ford accountable for that?
So this issue of the advertising there, again, being played up. But I believe at one point in time, the Remington's attorney, James Vogt, said advertising is protected speech. It's free speech anyway. Right?
Yeah. And he actually said for advertising to be actionable, it really needs to be deceptive or misleading. And actually, Big Tobacco was cited as an example of that. And he says in this case, Remington's advertising, which did use phrases by his own admission, like forces of opposition bow down, it wasn't deceptive or misleading. They were trying to capture market share. They were trying to get people interested in his product. He says it wasn't marketed specifically to civilians. He said it was, but it also was marketed to members of the military and law enforcement as well.
Well, we do have some more tape here, again, of James Vokes. This is the lawyer arguing on behalf of Remington. And it seems as if repeatedly throughout oral argument today, he basically kept turning to the fact that that gun manufacturers are protected by federal law. Here's what he said.
No matter how tragic, no matter how much we wish those children and their teachers were not lost and their families had not suffered, the law needs to be applied dispassionately.
Patrick, could you get any sense as to how these arguments may have fell upon the justices' ears? What was their questioning like?
You know, that's a really great question, and it's interesting. In terms of their questions to the attorney for the plaintiffs, representing the families, he was saying, well, you know, if we do grant this appeal, and if this case is reinstated here in state court in Connecticut, if this was to go before a jury, the lawyer for the families would really have to prove that there was a link between the shooter at Newtown and the marketing that Remington did, and that's a really, really tough bridge to build. In terms of questions towards the defense, a lot of them centered around the weapon itself, the size of magazine that was used for that weapon, and whether or not that is appropriate for really any type of civilian use.
Yeah. And I don't imagine that the court indicated today when they may come out with the decision.
No, it could be weeks. It could be months. At this time, we don't know.
Yeah. And if in the chance that they do find in favor of the family, next stop would be what, the United States Supreme Court?
So, again, it's really tough to predict with that. In this particular case, it would go back to state superior court here in Connecticut. So it's sort of complicated judicial logistics here. But this is a case that started in state court, was thrown out, and lawyers for the families are trying to get it reinstated here in state court. That's not to say that in the future it couldn't get bigger than that. But right now it's a state issue.
Right. Well, that's WNPR reporter Patrick Scahill bringing us up to speed on arguments heard today in Connecticut State Supreme Court about whether or not Remington could or should be held responsible for the Newtown mass shooting in 2012. Patrick, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And just as a reminder of how none of this is ever too far away, NPR is reporting that a shooter in Tehama County, Northern California, has killed at least 4 people in a rampage today that began at a home and went on to multiple locations, including an elementary school. At least 2 children have been wounded, we're seeing, including a student at Rancho Tehama Elementary School. And according to state officials, the shooter has been killed by police. Well, let's get the latest now from Berklee College of Music, because yesterday students marched down Boylston Street protesting the school's handling of sexual assault cases. Protest organizers, including first-year student Sky Stallman, are demanding that the college make changes to improve student safety, transparency, and uphold the school's zero-tolerance policy against sexual assault.
We are Berklee. There is no Berklee without its students. The students are what create Berklee. So we're here to bring forth what we believe is the definition and what our safety is contingent upon.
Now, yesterday, President Roger Brown also said that 11 faculty members had been dismissed since 2014 on accusations of sexual misconduct. And all of this is precipitated by reporting from the Boston Globe about Berklee's considerable problems with sexual harassment on campus. That reporting has been done by Boston Globe reporter Kay Lazar, and she joins us now. Kay, welcome back to the show.
Hi, good afternoon.
So you were there at the big forum that Berklee had yesterday, and you heard what President Roger Brown had to say. Can you tell us a little bit more about what steps you think Berklee is committed to taking to do something about a problem they seem to have on campus?
Well, the steps that Brown has committed to is creating a task force or a working group that's comprised of students and faculty and administration. There was a lot of back and forth about how many students should be on there. But the premise is that they will all start really speaking and working together about what the problems are and the best way to go forward. He has also committed taking a look at the policies for how Berklee handles students who have been found responsible for raping other students. There had been some really emotional back and forth about the fact that Berklee now allows these students to come back to campus. They're suspended for a period of time, but not expelled. There is strong feeling among students there that there should be expulsion for rapes.
Now, I imagine that you've been working on this story, investigating Berklee for months now. Did it come as a surprise to you when Brown said that 11 faculty members have been dismissed in the past 13 years?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, we had information on a number of other professors. We could not get the hard documentation we need to go with the professors and to name them. Some of the people did not want to come forward or did not feel comfortable going forward or did not feel comfortable providing the documentation. That documentation started to flow after our first story, and we were prepared to do a second story naming some other professors when the forum was announced that that Berklee changed plans and that they were going to have an open forum.
Right. So, I suppose for folks who missed your early reporting on this, I mean, let's just go back over that for a moment here, Kay, because, I mean, in your first story, you had detailed information, including text messages, regarding one former faculty member at Berklee, Jeff Galindo. What is he said to have done?
The woman who we spoke with said that he had, he was her mentor, and he was, one of her close teachers that she really respected and relied on. And she was attending a gathering, somewhat like a party after a concert, and had too much to drink and was feeling, not well. And he offered to take her home to make sure that she was arrived safely. And she was obviously blacking out, et cetera. And the next thing she remembered is waking up the next morning naked and with him lying next to her, groping her. And in the weeks and months after, he would send her texts essentially admitting to what happened and saying he was very, very sorry and he didn't mean for it to happen.
And you saw those texts?
Yes, she shared those texts with us.
Wow. And how did Berklee handle this situation when she first reported it to them?
Well, it took her several months mm-hmm. to come forward. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you can imagine, and she says that she was talked out of coming forward by various people. But that she finally did about 6 months later, and that they investigated, and eventually he was terminated. But that her contention was that administrators there convinced her not to move forward with any kind of case, even though, frankly, she was pretty reluctant to even go forward anyway, but that her concern was that he would teach again, and that she felt that that the administrators told her that would not happen. So she decided not to go forward with any kind of case beyond him being terminated from Berkeley.
But he did go on to teach again, right? At least two Boston area music schools.
That's correct. That is correct.
No, go ahead.
He went on to teach at the New England Conservatory and also at the Longy School of Music. So, yes, he did go on to teach again.
So, Kay, I wonder, you've been looking at this for months. You've been doing a deep investigation. Maybe now the dam is breaking a little bit in terms of information you might get from Berklee College of Music itself. But, do you have a sense that is there a significant and unusual problem at Berklee? Or, I don't know, if we were able to scratch the surface in other educational institutions around Greater Boston, would we find something similar? I keep coming back to this 11 faculty members dismissed in 13 years number, and that just seems shocking to me. But is it?
It seems staggering to us, too. And I will correct you. It wasn't months. It was more like weeks. This came to us suddenly, and it came from different sources, and we realized that we needed to jump on it quickly.
Okay.
So it was day and night working weeks,
okay,
not months. I wish I had months on that. There would have been many more names. But as far as how extensive this is in other schools, I don't know, and that's a really good question. We're starting to hear from readers about other schools, and certainly there have been other schools in the news for this. It's not unique to Berklee. The extent to which it has happened at Berklee seems unusual to us. One of the things that has been suggested is because it is a music school somehow, and because of the unique relationships students form, often performing at night, or that might lend itself. I don't know if there's any. That seems odd to me. But I don't know. It just seemed 11 faculty member in 13 years seemed extraordinary to us.
Hmm. Now, we talked a little earlier about the fact that President Brown has said that the school actually has a zero tolerance policy. Did he talk yesterday, or has, I don't know if they've talked to you since then, about how Berklee says it will actually uphold that policy?
Well, they've talked about really examining that and really taking a very close look with this new working group. We have repeatedly asked Roger Brown for an interview. They today now say that we may get finally a sit-down interview with him, so that is certainly a good question to ask him. We, as I said, we were not granted an interview up until now.
Hmm. And have you, since your report first came out, I think you might have said this a moment ago, but I just want to be sure I heard you correctly, have you heard from other students since then about fresh allegations?
Yes. Oh. One of the problems we're having is that we don't know all of the 11 names. We think we know some of them beyond the ones we reported, but we don't know all of them. And so it's hard to know when people are coming forward which ones we have to match with which professor. And there is some information that there may be one or two, well, more than one professor still there. That's problematic. That's some of the reports we've been getting.
Hmm. Well, Kay Lazar is a reporter for the Boston Globe, bringing us up to speed on her ongoing investigation into sexual harassment at Berklee College of Music. Kay, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We've got links to all of Kay's reporting, by the way, at our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I feel like I've said this before on the show, but I'm going to say it again. the robots are coming. They're coming for my job, for your job, and quite frankly, for a whole lot of jobs in the very near future. I mean, long story short, anything that can be automated probably will. So how are we really preparing young people for that future? Well, Joseph Ahun, president of Northeastern University, says it's time for higher education to consider reprogramming itself if colleges and universities are really going to fulfill their role in creating the lifelong learners and multi-skilled workers the future economy will demand. He lays out his ideas on how to do that in his new book, Robot Proof: Higher Education in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. And he joins me now in the studio. President Ahun, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Magna. It's good to be with you again.
It's good to have you. So let me just first ask you, we talk a lot about the AI and robotics future on this show, but if you were to take a typical college campus today, Northeastern, obviously, let's start there. I mean, how well is higher ed doing right now in preparing students for the future?
The students, Magna, are very engaged in this robotic aspect and the AI revolution. And they are aware that jobs are disappearing, yeah. And they are aware that jobs are that we will have no jobs. And they are the ones in various institutions pushing higher education to change in order to become even more relevant there for them and to prepare them to be robot-proof for life. I think it's driven by the students.
Yeah. Okay. So driven by students, well, and their awareness. That's good to know, because it seems like higher education is this massive ship that would take quite a bit of thinking and effort to turn that ship. I mean, what is it that higher education is doing fundamentally wrong that it needs to change?
I think the higher education has the ingredients, and the whole idea is to put them together in a different way in order to make people robot-proof. Specifically, in my book, what I'm advocating for is a new curriculum and that is what I call humanics. This curriculum, humanics, is focusing on the integration of three literacies. Every student should master the first literacy, obviously the tech literacy. Mm-hmm. How do machines and computers work? How can we interact with them? And we have to learn that aspect. The second literacy is the data literacy. We have to understand this enormous amount of information generated by computers and by smart machines, and we need to navigate that and make sense of it. Mm-hmm. And the third is the human literacy. Namely, every learner have to understand what makes us unique as human beings, namely the ability to be creative, to be entrepreneurial, to be innovative, the ability to be empathetic with other people, the ability to be culturally agile, to be global. And the integration of the three literacies will prepare us to be robot-proof.
Okay.
So that's what I'm advocating. But then the other question is going to be how to achieve that.
Right. I was going to say, practically speaking, what would that look like?
Well, for instance, take what I'm saying is that what we have to focus on is what makes humans unique with respect to machines, all these attributes that I mentioned to you before. But take creativity, take innovation, take entrepreneurship, take empathy, take cultural agility. How to achieve that? You don't achieve them by being in a course only and studying that. You don't become an entrepreneur or innovator or creator by being in a course. You have to practice that yourself. And this is where experiential education is key. So the second ingredient is experiential education. What is experiential education? It's the ability to integrate your classroom experience with the world experience.
I mean, is it something like Northeastern's co-op program?
The co-op programs, those internships that will allow you to be testing yourself, to understand what you're good at, to understand what you like, to be able to work with other people, to see what makes them move, what makes them is sad, what makes them happy, to be empathetic with them, to work in an environment that is global, that is culturally diverse. All these aspects happen
in an experiential mode such as co-op. Absolutely.
So let me ask you, I mean, I am very strongly persuaded by your underlying thesis here that the workers of the future or citizens of the future will need to be lifelong learners and have these sort of three prongs in terms of their approach to the world, the tech, the data, and the human literacy, especially the idea of being able to synthesize all that together.
Absolutely.
Having a facility and an agility, right? To apply their human creativity to all sorts of problems. But I wonder, again, practically speaking, beyond the experiential part, what is the college campus of the future look like? Is there going to be a history department? Is there going to be an engineering school? I mean, or are all those silos, should they go away?
Well, the silos by definition should go away. Those silos are relatively recent in our history. You know, when knowledge started increasing, we had silos. And now it's time to do the integration. But you ask me, how is the college of the future going to look like? As I mentioned earlier, and you mentioned that jobs are going to disappear. Various studies are indicating that close to 50% of the jobs will disappear in the next 20 years. Others will be transformed, and new jobs will arise. So people will have to be in a lifelong learning situation constantly. But somebody who is already working, like you and me, and we need to retool. We don't have the luxury to go back to a campus. Mm-hmm. We don't have the luxury to spend a year or two in a campus. The campus, the university has to come to us. The university has also to come to us and provide us with what we need based on our time, based on our need. So therefore, the campus of the future is a campus where personalization is going to be with you, where you are going to see the various universities becoming multi-universities, being there where you are, wherever you are, and providing you with whatever you need.
Through online learning?
Online is not enough.
Okay.
And, you know, we know that now various studies have shown that online is not enough. You need to be hybrid, namely online and experience, and also have the one-on-one interaction with people. That's the hybrid model. You need to be experiential in order to test what you are learning and to test yourself constantly. Mm-hmm. And that's why, online has not been the solution that everybody was expecting.
So, President Owen, I have to ask you, the idea that we should all be lifelong learners, absolutely true. But I'm also hearing a little bit of this as sort of the expansion of the role of higher education in all of our lives. And to me, one of the first responses I have is, that sounds really expensive. I mean, we already have a student debt problem here. How do we expect people to continuously go back to school repeatedly over...
Because what's happening now when you go, this idea of lifelong learning is not about spending a year or two. You are seeing the onset and the beginning of boot camps, micro-credentials, badges. So people, can afford that. And, when you look at the price point for those offerings, they are extremely reasonable. And in fact, prices have been going down from this perspective. So that's an investment that is going to pay off in a very big way.
Oh, but in an op-ed, I believe the last year in the Washington Post, you also wrote that you would hope that the federal government would be more creative in how it views its funding of higher education.
Absolutely, because we haven't invested in lifelong learning. Other countries are focusing on lifelong learning because they are extremely worried about the impact of robots and intelligent systems job creation and also job disappearance. So, they are working on real policies and laws that will allow people to re-educate themselves, reskill themselves. We had more of a laissez-faire attitude here, saying the problem will solve itself. Well, the problem is not going to solve it itself if 50% of the jobs that we know will disappear. Mm. Lifelong learning is not a luxury; it's a necessity.
Yeah, it seems like the blueprint that you've laid out is achievable for Northeastern, Harvard, MIT, UMass. you know, big established schools that have the connections in the business world. They have a variety of educators and research departments within their campuses, et cetera. But I wonder, where does this leave, you know, the small liberal arts school that may not have the facilities and resources that Northeastern does?
Well, what you are seeing is that the liberal arts schools are waking up to this enormous challenge and enormous opportunity. And so you are seeing various liberal arts schools integrating an experiential dimension on purpose in order to meet the needs of the students and make them robot-proof for life. So the liberal arts schools understand that this is an enormous opportunity for them, and that is something that is very laudable.
Mm. Now, for the sake of argument, let me ask you, what about the person out there who may be listening who says, I just want to study, I'll throw this out there, history. I just want to be an expert in 12th century South Asian history. What's so wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that. Quite the opposite. As a matter of fact, I mentioned that every learned citizen has to integrate three literacies. The tech literacy, the data literacy, and the human literacy. So let's go back to your point about history. History now, the study of history, the study of humanities, is being transformed by all the computational aspects. You are hearing digital humanities, the term digital humanities. What is it? It's the integration of all these computational tools that will allow you to understand literature, history, creativity. And that's what's happening. So quite the opposite. No one can afford not to integrate the three literacies. And the three literacies will allow you to enlighten your field of study, whether it is in pure technology or whether it's in the humanities or the social sciences. Mm.
Do you really think, just to kind of circle back to what I was asking you about smaller liberal arts schools, I want to press you on this a little bit, because do you really think that every institution of higher education in the United States can survive this transformation, if indeed it's what's needed for higher ed?
Look, let's go back to your point about liberal arts colleges. Yeah. Some liberal arts colleges, actually various liberal arts colleges, are being challenged. You are seeing waves of mergers, acquisitions, closure. And why? Because, in fact, they haven't kept up with what the needs of society and the needs of the learner. So the opportunity is precisely to move into this new domain, namely make people robot-proof by offering the humanities curriculum and experiential component. And that's what we are seeing the liberal arts schools experimenting with. Mm. Not everyone is doing that, but those who are, I think, are reaping already the benefit.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to education and its fundamental role in sort of our future society and economy, I can't help but to wonder, though, if focusing on higher ed, I mean, that's your world, so obviously you're going to do that. But it also seems like it's too late, right? If we wait until someone's 18, and also this being a person who has the wherewithal and the funding to be able to go to a college or university, which isn't everybody, if we wait until then for them to experience this humanics kind of curriculum, is it almost not too late? Should we also be looking further upstream?
You're absolutely right. Higher education and education in general has the responsibility of making people robot-proof throughout their lives from K to gray. Now, what are we doing? What is higher education doing for the K to 12? For instance, at Northeastern, what we have done is we have brought 70 schools from the United States and Canada precisely to try to integrate and work on the experiential component in their schools. Mm. So we need to be more active, more present, because that's a pipeline issue and that's a responsibility issue.
When you talk about this on Northeastern's campus, do you get any pushback from anybody, or is everyone pretty much on board saying this is the direction we need to go?
I mean, the whole academic plan at Northeastern, what we call Northeastern 2025, has been based on that.
Right.
And therefore, you know, the people who shape the academic plan are the faculty, the students, the staff, and, you know, the employers, 3,000 employers that we work with, say, you know, some of them were at the table to shape it with us. So there is a buy-in because this has been shaped by the community.
Otherwise, higher ed itself won't be robot-proof, right? Because it seems like those opportunities in that education can come from elsewhere.
Absolutely. And you are seeing that happening as we speak. You are seeing that, you know, companies and firms are establishing their own universities. They call it, you know, the IBM University, the GE University, the X University. And then when you talk to them, you ask them, why are you doing that? They say to you, this is not our core competence, but we're doing it because no one is meeting our needs. We need lifelong learning opportunities for the people in our companies. And therefore, as you said, if we don't do it, it's going to be done and it's not going to be done as well.
Hmm. Well, we just have a couple minutes to go, President Owen. This has been really fascinating. But I just want to turn a corner here for a moment because you are the president of a major American university. And you heard in the segment before you, we were talking to the Boston Globe about their reporting on Berklee College of Music, about sexual harassment issues on that campus. But, I mean, because you are the president of a major university, I just wanted to get your impressions about how this bigger issue of sexual harassment, I mean, what are the discussions like at Northeastern? How is Northeastern looking at its policies?
So every person in a learning environment or work environment has the fundamental right to feel secure and safe. And this is not negotiable. This is what we all have to do. And whenever there are issues, confront them head on. That's what we have to do. And this is not only about sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. Any form of discrimination that you are hearing about based on gender, based on religious, based on any dimension that you espouse, we should be promoting. We cannot afford this discrimination. Higher education has to be a model for society, not a follower only. Mm.
And do you feel that Northeastern has the procedures in place to confront things head on when necessary?
I feel that we have them, but nothing, no institution can say I can live on what I have. You always have to question yourself. After all, we are there as a learning institution. If we don't learn ourselves, we are not fulfilling our mission.
Does that mean that sorry, I'm a little confused, so forgive me, but does that mean that you're considering re-examining what Northeastern's policies
are? We do it constantly.
Okay.
We do it constantly. As a matter of fact, we always look at our policies. We always look at our procedures because our policies, our procedures in whatever field have to serve the community and not be there as an absolute. Mm. And, you know, that's what every learning institution should be doing. And I think, you know, that's an enormous opportunity for us, too.
Yeah. Well, Joseph Owen is president of Northeastern University. His new book is Robot Proof, Higher Education in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. It's been a pleasure to speak with you about
Thank
this, President
Owen.
Thank
you for having me again.
Looking forward to having you once more. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Red Sox Hall of Famer Bobby Doerr has passed away. He was 99 years old. The second baseman played all 14 years of his career with the Sox from 1937 to 1951, with the exception of 1945, when he served with the United States Army in World War II. Doerr was also the hitting coach for the Sox during their 1967 Impossible Dream Team. In 1986, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Here he is speaking in Cooperstown.
I thank God I could grow up in a country that I could choose a profession I love so much. Growing up, I'd hoped I could become a major league ball player and then hoped I could play in an all-star game and a World Series. Being inducted to the Hall of Fame today just tops off all the nice things that ever happened to me in baseball.
There's a lot of nice things that happened to him, too. 2 years later, in 1988, his number one was retired by the Sox. Joining me now to remember Bobby Doerr is Dick Flavin. He's the poet laureate of the Red Sox. Mr. Flavin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It is an absolute delight to have you. Also with me is sports writer and Red Sox historian Gordon Eads. Gordon Eads, it is a delight to see you once again. Welcome.
Thank you.
Of course, I'm sad to say that we're coming together over the passing of Bobby Doerr, but let's spend some time remembering him. I was looking at how Bob Ryan described Doerr today, and he just comes out and say it: best Red Sox second baseman ever. Agree? Disagree?
I agree. Absolutely.
What made him such a great player?
Everything. I mean, he could do everything. He was a wonderful fielder, a really solid hitter, and just a steady influence on everyone else on the team, particularly on Ted Williams, who needed a steadying influence.
You know, one of the great stories, and Dick, you're well acquainted with it, of Bobby and the impact he had on that great team in the 40s, which probably should have won the World Series, and we shouldn't have gone 86 years without winning a World Series, is that, Ted referred to him as the silent captain of the Red Sox, and he truly was a confidant for Ted, that oftentimes when Ted was upset about something and they were on the road, that he would ask Bobby to go for a walk. And he'd only ask Bobby. I mean, that's the kind of confidence he had in Doerr.
Well, Ted, had no real growing up period in his life. His parents were missing most of the time, and he was like a wild animal, an uncaged wild animal when he first came up. And Bobby was a steadying influence on his life. Ted didn't have many leaders. Bobby was Ted's leader.
Magna, the David Halverson, who of course wrote The Teammates, and he used a wonderful phrase to describe Bobby. He said that he had uncommon emotional equilibrium. And I think if you look at the tributes that have come pouring in today from guys that either knew Bobby when he was a coach or from his visits back here, you, over and over again you hear the phrase, he was about the nicest guy I ever met, including Danny Ainge, the general manager of the Boston Celtics, the NBA Celtics. Danny, of course, was a baseball player at one time and with the Toronto Blue Jays, and Bobby Doerr was a hitting coach for the Blue Jays. And Ainge said, he was my introduction to baseball, and he's the nicest human being I've met in 40 years of professional sports.
And Dick, Gordon just mentioned David Halberstam's book, The Teammates, about that famous trip that you took with Dom DiMaggio and Johnny Pesky to visit Ted Williams. I just wonder, could you tell us more about that trip?
It was Bobby was not on that trip. Bobby's own wife was dying at that point, and so he stayed at home in Oregon while we made the trip. We drove down from Boston to Florida, and the reason we drove was it was right after 9/11. We didn't want to get all messed up with the security in and around Logan Airport, it was so interesting, that trip down there. We never turned the radio on once. It was that interesting. And then, of course, when we get down to see Ted, once we get used to the fact that he had become an invalid at that point, it was terrific. And Ted would constantly test us on what we knew. He was an interesting character. He was always pushing people.
I really want to just talk for a moment about how Bobby Doerr was as a player, because as I've been sort of catching up today on his considerable skills, I mean, we talked about his dominance as a second baseman, because he played second base every game that he played for over 14 years at the Red Sox.
He did, Magna. And I mean, his bona fides are unquestioned. I mean, he was a 9-time All-Star. He drove in 100 runs or more.
Yeah,
six
not too
times.
Shabby at the plate.
No, particularly for a second baseman. He was the Red Sox leading hitter in the 1946 World Series, hit over 400. But again, it was typical of Bobby's character. So when asked what his greatest thrill was in baseball, he mentioned Ted's game-winning home run in the 1941 All-Star game in Detroit off of Claude Pasa. Well, 2 years later, Bobby actually hit a home run himself in an All-Star game in 1943. Walker Cooper threw him a hanging curve. Dorr said, I'll always remember that pitch. But it was typical of Dorr that he would cite something that Ted did as his favorite moment rather than something he did.
Now, he had to retire in 1951, right? Bad back?
Yeah, bad back.
He was. It was a cold night in Cleveland in April. He came into field a slow roller. He felt something give in the back. It got so bad he wound up wearing a corset, couldn't even bend down to tie his shoes. So that cut his career short at what, 33 years old?
33 right? years old.
He had to hate that, right? I mean, he could have played for longer.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
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 Well, we actually have another clip of Bobby Dorr speaking. This is in 1952, so the year after he had to retire. And it's from, I love this clip so much, I can't even tell you. It's from the This I Believe series from Edward R. Murrow. And Bobby Dorr did a This I Believe, and he talked about his decision to retire. And this, I think it just encapsulates Bobby Dorr, the gentleman.
Another belief very important to me is that I'm only as good as my actual performance proves that I am. I thought of this when in the season of 1951, I told my teammates that I would not play in 1952 because I realized that I wouldn't be able to give my best performance to the people who would pay my salary by coming through the turnstiles. For me, most of the satisfaction in any praise I receive comes from the feeling that it is a reward for a real effort I have made.
It's Bobby Dorr in 1952. What is it? What do you feel when you hear that?
Well, one of the things I feel is I'm very impressed that your staff would have pulled out an interview with Edward R. Murrow. That's the first time I had ever heard that. But again, I think it speaks to what Dick was saying about how he was such a beloved teammate and the fact that he was always giving credit to them before himself.
You know, when I was growing up, he was the favorite player of almost everyone that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Ted was in another category. His talent and his personality and his faults were so supersized that we couldn't identify with him. But everyone that I knew practically had a Bobby Dorr model glove, and he was great, and he was Ted's favorite player too, because Ted looked up to him so much.
Yeah, you know, so they came close to a World Series championship in 46. So when they finally won it, Bobby Dorr was what, 86 years old the year that the Sox actually won World Series. I mean,
yeah.
did any of you have a chance? Either of you had a chance to talk to him about it when they finally did win?
Well, they did give him a World Series ring.
They did,
as they did with Johnny Pesky,
yeah.
And of course he was thrilled, as was anyone who had ever worn the uniform.
Yeah.
But you know, at that point in his life, man, Bobby loved Oregon. He loved living on a river in Oregon. He loved to fish. That was one of the things he and Ted had in common. But one of the things, and I don't use this word lightly, but that kind of made him noble in many ways, is his wife, Monica, and that was almost a storybook romance. She was teaching in a one-room schoolhouse in Oregon when he met her. She was stricken with multiple sclerosis still in the 40s when he was playing. It went into remission, but then in 1967, when he was the hitting coach on the Impossible Dream Red Sox, another pennant-winning team, she collapsed in the middle of the street in Boston. The disease had come back. She spent most of the rest of her life in wheelchairs and then suffered a couple of strokes. But Bobby Dorr, He made a pact with his wife that they were not going to treat her as an invalid and that they were going to live life regardless. But he took such glorious care of her. That was the reason he didn't make the trip with you, Dick,
that's
right?
That's exactly right.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, I think that's a beautiful anecdote about sort of who he was as a man to end on. Dick Flavin, poet laureate of the Boston Red Sox, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Gordon Eads, Red Sox historian, always a pleasure to have you, Gordon. Thanks, you.
Man.
Both of them joined me today to remember Bobby Doerr, legendary Red Sox second baseman who died at the age of 99. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.